Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And tonight we have a very special guest with us, a returning visitor, Greg Davies. How are you, Greg?
Ding ding, round three. Here we go.
you're gonna get like the SNL award, you know, where you're on your way towards the five timer.
You're our own personal Justin Timberlake.
Oh God. Oh, well, hello everyone. Dilly gaff to you, internet. Thanks for having me on the Drill Down this week, guys. It's an absolute pleasure.
Absolutely. This week, Turkey tries to terminate Twitter. Netflix cries not fair. The IRS weighs in on Bitcoin. President Obama backpedals on NSA collection. Apple, Google, and dozens more collude in wage fixing. And will Facebook's purchase of Oculus create a rift amongst gamers? All this and more on The Drill Down tonight. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription links are all in our show notes. And please leave us a review on iTunes. Facebook.com and Twitter.com at The Drill Down, and you can write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show is also on Stitcher at Stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And a couple things I want to talk about. I just finished a game that I mentioned briefly last year, I think, in our holiday shopping guide. Called Device 6, and I played with it a little bit back then and then set it down and didn't pick it up again until recently. And recently I finished going through all the chapters of this game, and I'm absolutely in love with it. It's a very innovative game. It's one I wish they had a sequel to, although I don't think it's in the cards. It's essentially like an interactive text story. And as you play the game, the text is all laid out in front of you, and it's for the iOS or for mobile devices. So as you're playing, you scroll the screen to make the text sort of go by. And as you do so, it starts to become interactive in that you hear sort of the sounds that you're reading about, and you see images that are referred to in the story, and then you have to solve puzzles that the story sets up for you. It's
kind of like a modernized version of those old DOS-based games where it was like you were in a castle and you had to follow the text to complete your map.
Yeah, kind of like that, or kind of like a text version of Myst, you would. So, but incredibly inventive, great graphic design on the book itself, and some cool music. Just every aspect of the game is a lot of fun. It's made by Simogo, who also recently created a game called Year Walk, which was a critically acclaimed game. But this was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. I highly recommend it. It's not a long game. Like, it'll take you maybe a day or two, and then you'll be done with it. It's like six chapters in all, but it was a lot of fun to go through. And the other thing I wanted to talk about was the new washer-dryer set that I just purchased, because the old washer that I had broke. And so it's been like almost 10 years since I bought a washer-dryer. And I didn't realize how sort of teched up these guys are these days. So the washer dryer that I got now is the Maytag Maxima X front load washer, and it has a like a steam cycle to it. Steam cleans your clothes during a certain part of the cycle, which they claim to that'll remove 99% of household bacteria. They also have an allergen removal washer cycle, which eliminates 95% of common allergens. It's all like touchscreen capable. They have an option to allow your clothes to spin for 6 hours every few minutes or so, just to keep them fresh in case you set the washer and you can't get to it in time to take the clothes out.
So no Wi-Fi, huh?
No Wi-Fi, though they did have Wi-Fi options in some of the higher price models. What those offered was pretty cool, too, because you could check the status of your wash via Wi-Fi and also schedule the wash via Wi-Fi remotely.
Dwayne and I had a spirited conversation about this before the recording of the show started, and I still say it's a scam.
I don't know. I think the idea that everything should be connected is really helpful. If you can have like some sort of way to monitor your entire house. I don't know. I'm into the quantified self, so I kind of want to know everything I've engaged with all the time. For me, I was talking about my holy grail, which would be a washer-dryer combo. Spin your clothes one way, get them clean. Spin your clothes the other way. They're all dry and ready to go. I do love the feature of the continual spinning. It's been around for a few years now. And the only annoying thing is that if you fall asleep because you're doing a late load of laundry, yeah, and you don't tell the machine not to sound, it'll beep every 30 minutes for like 6 hours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which can be a bit heavy.
Yeah, that is the only one of the only drawbacks to our model is it's extremely touch sensitive. So you just brush against the face, and you'll set some sort of option on the machine, but they do have a lockout switch that you can lock it out, and they also have a silence option, yeah, so that you don't have to hear all the beeping all the time.
So is the machine like the interface, is it kind of one of those touch pads where you like press thing, or is it more capacitive?
It's more capacitive. Yeah,
that's good, because I think that's the biggest innovation with these things is the interface. They really have to get that right, because right now, just pressing a whole bunch of LED-type button things on a sticker, what these touchpads are, isn't the best experience. There is something solid to that feeling, and I know it's an interim stage between the switches and dials we used to have.
Yeah.
But really, where Wi-Fi can get strong is not so much in the scheduling or whatever. I mean, that's always good stuff. You always want that. Energy consumption would be nice to know if you're just a geek. But really, it's just like if I could pull up an app and tell it what I want it to do,
mm-hmm,
once I put the clothes in, and then walk away from it on my iPad or my iPhone or my Android device. That's the way to keep the thing fresh. That way, the interface can be updated by the company. New functionality can be added if the hardware supports it. And I feel like that approach should be taken to everything in the home. My TV has it. You know, my PlayStation has it. My Bluetooth speaker has it. My like Wemo, Belkin, you know, control devices have it. You can update their firmware. You can get more functionality out of them. I think that's really what I think where the innovation needs to go, instead of sort of these single use durable goods that kind of stagnate over time.
Well, the buttons are static, but they are capacitive in that you don't have to apply any pressure. It just goes off the warmth of your fingers, the connection that your fingers make.
Not unlike the new quirky Wi-Fi connected air conditioner, which has capacitive buttons, but they're dedicated buttons. Yeah. So one is on off, one is, you know, this, that.
Exactly.
It's just, I think the next step is really just to get these things kind of appified, Wi-Fi connected for updates, data. And frankly, the biggest thing is if they can get aggregate data from every single machine they sell, over the course of the lifetime of that product, they'll be able to do things like issue recalls or figure out problems before they really begin, or at the very least make the next product that much better.
It's like
if they don't want the planned obsolescence that we all know that they're trying to hit anyway.
It's a two-way conversation between the machine and the manufacturer.
Yeah. Yeah. they need to be able to. I mean, I know at first glance, yeah, just send the data. But it'd be great if the machine sends data back to the resource sensor. But it'd be just really good if you know that the new functionality would come to your machine based on what the hardware is capable of. Because that and the manufacturer that gets that right, the manufacturer that focuses on a commitment to success, and making people happy, that's going to be the manufacturer that that gets people to come back.
I appreciate technological innovation in all aspects of basically any aspect of my everyday life, particularly the stuff that I use every day, like washers and dryers. And
exactly. In fact, this year is the centennial of the First World War. And that seems random, except for the fact that the First World War is when many historians, everyone from, you know, people who like study modern history to all the geeks who love steampunk. It's a hallmark and a change in the way we look at modernity and specifically technology. Mm-hmm. And there are like plenty of weird tech innovations that you wouldn't even have known. I mean, obviously tanks came out of the First World War, but yeah. There's also all this random stuff that came out of the First World War's technology that, I'm going to try to bring into what we're playing with.
Barbed wire was one of the technologies that was, that came out of the First World War too. It was probably out of the 20th century. It was the most revolutionary period in history across the globe.
Yeah,
In
terms of technological revolution.
Yes, I would agree. I think it had played a much bigger importance in the way that the century played out, as opposed to the Second World War, which seems to get a lot more play. And as a matter of fact, I'm glad you brought up the whole centennial, Dwayne, because you know. And we've talked about this on the Blendover podcast too. You know, it's just not been spoken about in the media. Have you noticed this? That there's no coverage or no memorialization of where we were a century ago.
I think as important as it is, it's so far removed from modern. It's history book history. Which
it isn't though. It's only 100 years old. Just think about it this way: In 1965, they were talking about the end of slavery, which obviously was a very huge deal. And then just last year in 2013, the news media covered for the entire month of August the March on Washington, another monumental change. With the death of Nelson Mandela, we got a lot of stuff at the end of last year regarding, you know, the fall of apartheid. The World War, the Great War, it changed the entire planet. It was pervasive. The map that we grew up knowing was drawn out of that war.
And basically it had as much impact on culture across the world as what the Industrial Revolution had.
Right, or the Internet Revolution.
Well, right? In modern terms, you would say the Internet Revolution in terms of connectivity and the development of technology. And quite frankly, we really have only seen it in its infancy at this point. On the last night's episode of Blendover, Ryan Miller and myself covered in detail a lot of the discussion focused on automation technology, mainly robotics and other things that are happening. And we were really focusing on the discussion of how that will impact the economy as we know it in this day and age. And quite frankly, none of us really have a good, adequate idea as to how it's going to impact. I mean, hell, even Bill Gates is saying that robots are going to take everyone's jobs away. So where are we going to stand economically? I mean, we're standing on the precipice of a new revolution. So this whole thing with the internet and smartphones and mobile devices and shit, even Google Glass for crying out loud, that this is just the beginning. We're just starting.
Yeah, and that's not even to say what happens when we begin to move into the biotech. The ability to use designer drugs to weed out specific diseases based on our based on our DNA and based on our personal needs. Once we get into that space, people start living incredibly longer. Hardware, you know, robotics begins to get integrated into our lives. I mean, they're already talking about creating key fobs that you just embed into your skin so that you don't have to walk with a key at all. It's always on you. Things like that. So. Yeah, I mean that's a revolution that happened, but let's never forget that mass production really began in strength you know, with the Model T at around the time of World War One, right. 10 years before World War One, rather. And once World War One shows up, you've basically had kings and queens. Let's not forget, these countries were run by kings and queens. Royalty, who had benefited from 10 years of mass production, basically building as many weapons and other toys and war and toys of war that they could, just waiting for something to happen so that they could use them almost. I mean, that's a really pessimistic way to talk about it, but the technology really fueled the way that we could do things. And by do things, in this case, it really meant exert your will across the world. That's what's so crazy about it.
The other thing about World War One that's interesting is that it was the only war of the 20th century protested by banks before the British decided to get involved. They thought it was going to be bad for business. And, of course, ever since then, they've worked out that it has been nothing but profitable. Right. So ever since then, they've never protested war. World War One is the only war in the last 100 years where bankers protested. Isn't that interesting?
It is, especially when you look at the Crimea situation today, where we're waging war directly with banks. I mean, not with banks, against banks, but like using banks as the weapon as opposed to firing shots at the stage in the game. So anyway, World War One, crazy tech innovation. Greg just mentioned barbed wire. Think about the effect of barbed wire in our lives here in the States and anywhere. And next week we'll drop you another just kind of random thing that you don't even think about that showed up because, you know, 50 million people were in conflict, armed conflict.
Absolutely, absolutely. Good idea. I applaud you, Dwayne. That's a fantastic idea for this show. I think it's great.
Thanks, man.
Greg, you said that you had something, that you did have something that you were playing with.
Yeah, it's not a device, but just a little app that I stumbled across on Google Play today. It's a little puzzle game called 2048.
Oh.
Some of you may have already seen it before, and I'm pretty sure it might even be loosely based on something that's already out there on the market. But I'm a sucker for those games that are just like logic-based, space-based, or number-based, something that doesn't involve candy or jewels, you know. And so when I see stuff like this, it's actually what you need to do is you've got a grid of 4x4, and you basically – do you remember those old little sliding puzzles that we used to have when we were kids? It's that kind of structure, but it's with numbers. And if you match numbers together – they double. So, you know, if you got a two, if you match a two with a two, it becomes four. Fours become eight, then 16, 32, 64, like and so
you,
on.
You slide two tiles that are both numbered two together, they and become one tile that is numbered four.
Right. Exactly. And so the idea is that it's the quest to create a tile that makes 2048.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
it's pretty addictive, but it's a lot of fun.
And harder than you might imagine.
Yes, indeed, it is.
Yeah, that is a fun little app, and I haven't had much chance to play with it. I actually played with the web version of that. I haven't had a chance to play with it on the site itself. But
it's pretty responsive on the app. You know, it's quite simple and very quick, and you know, it's very simple. It's a good one of those like time-wasting games, like when you're waiting for an appointment or, you know, Bob's in the bathroom before you and you're waiting and, you know, something you can do while you're waiting. So that's cool.
That's like, to me, that's like the strength. That's like an app's best qualifier. Mm-hmm, if it's an app that I pop open because I'm like, I got a second, 30 seconds or a minute to waste, to me, that app is exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a hallmark of an addictive, sticky app.
Sticky.
Thank you. Yeah, sticky. Especially in this age where I've given up Facebook for Lent, I need more apps in my life like that.
I admire your
intestinal fortitude.
Yes. All right, let's get into some of these headlines here. So last week, Turkey blocked access to Twitter in the run-up to a heated election that saw social media become a battleground for pro and anti-government factions. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Pledged to eliminate access to the service entirely after tweets were published linking him to corruption. Erdogan said, "We now have a court order. We'll eradicate Twitter." at a campaign rally. Everyone browsing the web uses DNS, which is a system that routes the domain name you type into the browser to the IP address of that site. And Google provides a free DNS service that's open to all. And with knowledge of this, some Turkish citizens spread the word that using Google DNS will avoid the Twitter ban. And this is one of the most interesting things that came up out of this is graffiti began showing up bearing Google's DNS 8888. Mm-hmm. The circumvention methods worked very well for Turkish Twitter users, and activity in the company rose 138%. That is until the Turkish government turned up the heat by blocking access to the Google public DNS service. They released a memo to explain the government's position. They said that there are hundreds of court rulings in Turkey ordering Twitter to remove content, but Twitter has yet to abide by them.
What a load of crap that is! Yeah. Seriously, yeah. I mean, Andy, one of the episodes of Blendover that you and I did, I titled it "Get Your Filthy Hands Off Our Internet," and this is essentially the same situation here. I mean, you take away somebody's internet or an aspect of the internet like this, and you are stepping on the people. You are taking away something that they have a right to access, and it's censorship essentially. And you're destroying an element of society that is basically a right for communication.
Absolutely. It's becoming a basic human right, considered a basic human right around the world these days. And what's more, it's free communication on the internet is the genie in the bottle that you've released, and you can't put that genie back into the bottle again once it's been let out.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things where it's just very clear that, you know, Turkey's sitting there on the crossroad of Europe and the Middle East. They've seen what happens when Twitter is allowed to do what it needs to do when you're under a whack regime. And Erdogan is whack. There's no doubt about it. Erdogan currently has a warrant for the arrest of an Islamic cleric who lives in, I think, Pennsylvania, because that man has spoken out against Erdogan from both a religious perspective and a freedom of the people political perspective. He does so pretty quietly, and then his followers go and they take that message back to Turkey. But Erdogan is a person who, not unlike Vladimir Putin, does not allow for dissent in his in what he considers to be his government. Now it's a parliamentary system, so it is his party's government. But he essentially approaches it as if it's not the kind of rule where, England is a parliamentary system, Australia is a parliamentary system. You can have dissenting voices, and they can row, they can do whatever. In Erdogan's government, dissent is chased down and arrested. Not unlike how...
Can I just interject for a second? I just want to add something to what you're saying in agreement to you, but... One of the things that we're missing here that I think is extremely important to emphasize is that you may remember 9 months ago there was upheaval and riots in the street of Turkey. There was all kinds of trouble going on. Now, you may think that that's not been happening since that time because there's been nothing on the TV about it. But I can tell you the upheaval and the riots have continued nonstop since 9 months ago, right up until today. They're still continuing. There are people protesting on the streets. And this is the whole thing about Twitter is the first media coverage that the United States has brought forth since, 6 months ago or something like that. So I just wanted to underscore what you were saying, Dwayne. There's a lot of stuff that the mainstream audience, if you will, are kind of not subject to because the media chooses to focus on some topics rather than others, such as, you know, a missing plane for 16 fucking days.
Without getting too much into MH370, I will say that the amount of time and energy spent on tracking a plane that had no real ability to be tracked was a little frustrating from a technological standpoint. That said, you look at what's going on in Turkey. And the reason why it's so interesting is because Turkey is one of the few let's call it a Middle Eastern country. Let's call it an Islamic country.
Sure.
It's one of the few Islamic countries that that has sought secular government. Mm-hmm. Ataturk, the man for who was given the honorific of the father of Turkey, he took actually the nation that came out of the First World War, and he turned that into the modern day Turkey, a place where you walk on the west side of it, and it seems as if you're in Greece or any other part of the eastern part of classical Europe, and on the east side of it, you come out and you know you're in the Middle East, and there's a gradient that happens across it, and the land is beautiful and it's great, and the people have adopted this very focused and secular government in order to make sure that business works, in order to make sure that they're not shrouded, and that people have the ability to people have the ability to practice whatever they want to practice. But Erdogan, who's currently in control, has pretty much gone super crazy conservative on the nation in many ways, with the exception of obviously like terrorism and so on and so forth. But he's cracked down on dissent, and in doing that, he's asserted all these rights that no leader of a free nation would assert. And because of that, you know, he's scared of Twitter. That's why Twitter's banned.
First thing you do is eliminate free press if you want to.
Shut everybody up and only have your message come out.
Yeah.
That's what happens. I mean, you see it in Russia with journalists just dying, right? A female journalist just disappears and then her body's found X amount of days later. It's like a game of House of Cards. But yeah, with Erdogan, it's pretty much shut up or get out. We've seen this in Egypt too. But yeah, so it's disturbing that he tried to shut down Twitter. The good news about it is that we have a V for Vendetta like graffiti situation. At least something in the world knows. And Twitter, you know, unlike Google in China, is just letting it happen. They're not going to turn off the service. They're not going to do whatever. They know that they're a force for good in the world. And remember, Google in China a few years ago, Google said, we're just pulling out because everything we've done, we've given the names of the centers to Chinese, and they've been arrested and stuff like that. So we're just going to pull out because we don't want to actually fight this fight. Whereas Twitter is kind of like, we're just going to be there. It's also important to mention that Twitter allows you to send messages via text message. Mm-hmm. It's part of its fundamental situation. So news can get out as long as people have phone service, as long as their SMS messages are able to move. And that's a key facet of what Twitter's about and why it's
Twitter's based on that. Twitter, that's the basis of Twitter.
Well, that's when it was founded. It was focused on that. It's since primarily moved to the internet, but yeah, it's always had that functionality, and that's why it's been a big deal for so long.
Right.
Yeah, it's worth noting also that a Turkish court has lifted the ban on Twitter as of Wednesday. So we'll see where it stays from there.
I think this is going to be the launch pad, if you will, for the next round of stuff about Turkey that's going to be focused in the mainstream media over the coming months. I think in April and May, I think we're going to see Turkey quite a lot on the mainstream news here in the United States. This is just a teaser.
You think this is going to be the next Arab Spring?
Oh, this has been ongoing since last year, mate. It's still going. It hasn't stopped. The U.S. media just haven't covered it.
Well, now maybe I think you strike against one of the most popular social networks in globally, and you're going to put yourself on the map to be noticed.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's move on here. In a blog post last Thursday, Netflix CEO Reed Hastings called Comcast's interconnection fees, which we discussed last week on the Drill Down, an arbitrary tax on content providers, one that could harm the web. Drawing comparisons to the debate over net neutrality, Hastings said that ISPs send internet traffic to each other all the time for free, but demand payment from third-party content companies just because they can. He says they effectively control access to millions of consumers and are willing to sacrifice the interests of their own customers to press Netflix and others to pay. It's important to point out that the issue at stake, peering and interconnection, was not formally recognized as a net neutrality issue by the FCC. in 2010. Paid peering is growing more common these days in the industry. And as a response to that, AT&T Senior Executive Vice President Jim Ciccone argued that Netflix is trying to get everyone to foot the bill for someone the company should have to pay for themselves. He says in a blog post, when Netflix delivered its movies by mail, the cost of delivery was included in the price of the price the customer paid. It would have been neither right nor legal for Netflix to demand a customer's neighbors to pay the cost of delivering the movie. Yet that's effectively what Mr. Hastings is demanding here. Netflix may now be using an internet connection instead of the postal service, but the same principle applies. If there's a cost of delivering the movies at the quality level he desires, and there is, it should be borne by Netflix and recovered in the price of the service. That's how every form of commerce works in
that's
our country.
Outrageous.
That is okay. So, like, before we go into like how I feel about it,
yeah,
there is a fundamental misunderstanding of the internet in the basis of his thesis.
Okay.
The fact is, when I send an email to you, I'm sending it, you know, from a library, right?
Yeah.
The fact is, I'm not like you're not paying to get that email nicely, right? If you're in a public school, if you're in any kind of place, you're not paying a crazy fee to get that email with all the text in it. The whole point.
Postage.
Yeah, the whole point of the internet is that you're able to communicate effectively, quickly, and so on. And the message that is sent is the message that is received. That is like the biggest piece of the internet. Jimmy Carter himself says that because of monitored communications, he still sends snail mail letters. But the fact is, when Netflix is pushing out their stuff, when Netflix was pushing out their stuff on the internet, AT&T and those guys are like, okay, whatever. But now that there's money in it, they're like, oh, we want a piece of that. And that's really what this comes down to. Their financial incentive is completely and focused based on the fact that they want to tax the internet. They want to tax the internet. It's as simple as that. And it's kind of sad to see them jump into money, that.
Go the ahead. Money that you're talking about, though, this is imaginary money. I mean, this is stuff that they've dreamed up. The whole concept of turning bandwidth into a commodity is fucking outrageous, and it should have been stomped on years ago.
And the fact is, these people are paying for their cable subscription anyway. If I'm paying for 30 megabits down and Netflix is streaming this to me at 2 megabits, there's absolutely no reason why I shouldn't be able to take this down without having to pay an extra fee for it. They're trying to add a cost to content that is coming over at a price that is too – a price and means that is too efficient for their ancient business model to support.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Applause to you, sir. That's absolutely dead on there. And these companies, I mean, the people that are running these companies ought to be ashamed of themselves. They really should, because if what they should be doing is learning to make their services better quality. Because really, when you look at the surveys from people who are leaving companies like Comcast, like AT&T, when they're leaving those companies, it's usually with a great deal of dissatisfaction. And the problem with that is that you've got these giant telcos here in the United States, and they're all playing politics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah. It's always elucidating for me to bring up an issue like this on the show, because this was something that I really, listening to both sides, I really wasn't sure where to stand on this, but hearing the two of you sort of hash it out seems to be make it a lot more clear for me. So.
But see, that's the thing, Andy. We tend as humans to forget the original inception of the network, of the way the network was. I'm not necessarily talking about the World Wide Web. I'm talking the internet as a whole. It's decentralized by nature, and the whole purpose of using and creating this was to eliminate things like postage, you know?
Yeah.
That was the whole point. You know, you pay a flat fee for your ISP, for your internet service, and that's it. That's it.
I pay for my internet coming into my house. Netflix pays for its internet going out of its house. So whoever they're using for their service, they're paying them a price.
And those guys are trying to deliver it. And when it gets to Comcast Network, Comcast is doing what we used to do in Amherst College when the MP3 situation was threatening lawsuits from big names. We slowed down that type of traffic. We slowed it down because, frankly, our actual internal network was suffering a bit. It was the year 2000. And because we got letters from Sony saying, we're going to sue you, but we weren't willing to tell people that they couldn't download X, Y, or Z because that's ridiculous. You want to download an MP3? It might take you a 5 or 6 minutes instead of 2 seconds, but it's going to take you 5 or 6 minutes because we're going to like make sure that you can't download 50 million MP3s at once and get us all sued. Comcast is effectively saying, we're going to slow down the data when it comes to us because we're not afraid of getting sued by anybody. But what we're afraid of is that people won't use our services, which are crappy, bad. Yeah. It's the same exact argument that taxi and limousine commissions are using to fight things like Lyft and Uber. Our services suck, right. But this thing is disrupting us, and we can't have that.
Right.
So we're going to take whatever means necessary. The politicization is exactly right. You know, just like how these taxi and limousine commissions run to the mayors of the cities and say, or the courts or whatever, these guys are trying to run to the FCC and the FTC, net neutrality, this, that, and they're just trying to make it seem as if, you know, they're being taken for a ride when in fact, no, their business model's flawed, and if you can't beat them, join them.
Okay, moving on here. The IRS has cleared up a pressing tax question over virtual currencies just in time for the filing date in April. On a notice issued on Tuesday and reported by the Wall Street Journal, they clarified that Bitcoin and any other online money will be taxed as property, not currency. That distinction is important because Bitcoin's 100-fold price increase last year minted many new millionaires, but no one was sure how to report the gains. Currency profits are taxed at a 60-40 rate that blends long-term and short-term capital gains. But if Bitcoin is considered a capital asset, it'll be taxed at the long-term capital gains rate.
Yep, they want a piece. That's what it is.
Yeah, I think we're going to start to see a more...
It makes sense. It makes a lot of sense if you think about it. Bitcoin has been focused on this idea that, you know, we are something that you can use to facilitate commerce. How do you get us? Mm-hmm. You mine us. Once it's mined, how do you get it? You pay for one or a piece of one or whatever. So the idea that the IRS is going to take a look at this and say, well, Congress hasn't done anything because this doesn't do anything these days. This is clearly a means of commerce. We have to track commerce. That's our mandate. We have to track commerce and income because if we don't, then oligarchies arise more quickly than they already do. So understanding the value of what you have is best described by saying, look, it calls itself a piece of virtual coinage, just like a doubloon or any other thing that gains value as it gains time. We're gonna sit on it, just like if you owned gold or something. And in some respects, if you become a multimillionaire from Bitcoin and you're holding onto your Bitcoin, you're actually gonna keep more money than if it was just random income, because capital gains tax is not as onerous as income tax. That's why when you look at, you know, Warren Buffett saying that his secretary gets taxed at a higher rate than he does, it's because his money comes from capital gains, which is treated as sort of a, oh, you're gaining capital through the markets. Okay, go ahead, do it. Whereas the secretary is getting paid a paycheck and that gets taxed higher. So she's getting paid, you know, let's call it $100,000 a year or something. So if it's kind of not a terrible thing for the Bitcoin owner, and it seems like a kind of stopgap for the IRS. What's weird, though, is how late this comes in the tax season. This information should have come out on January 1st.
Agreed.
Coming out now, there are people who have already filed their taxes for 2013 and have tried to deal with the Bitcoin thing, but maybe they failed, maybe they've been holding off for whatever reason, or maybe they said, you know what, screw it, and now they've got to go and figure out how to deal with this new information that comes – 20 days before the deadline.
Yeah, but you can actually make amendments to your tax returns.
You can, but it is a pain in the butt. And the fact is the IRS could have figured this out earlier, you know, instead of chasing down random, you know, 501(c)s because they thought they were politically connected.
Right. You guys heard the latest about Dogecoin?
Dogecoin?
Dogecoin is going to be sponsoring someone in NASCAR.
Well, they could probably afford it with the how the rate the currency is at now.
I know. It flew out of the, everyone's expectations, beyond everyone's expectations, yeah. I should say. So, you know, perhaps there is something more to the... I mean, I admit I was a skeptic, and I still am a little skeptical about Bitcoin. You know, it's certainly gone beyond my expectations, and it looks like it may have some legs now.
Well, it's only a joke until it's not. Right?
Yeah, until they want their peace.
So who knows? I mean, maybe there is, like you said, some legs to Dogecoin yet, and we'll see. You know, people years from now, people will be trading heavily in Dogecoin, and we'll joke about the origin of the name, and that'll be the only sort of humorous thing about it.
We'll be upset that the Dogecoins aren't Wi-Fi connected.
Right.
Yeah, archaeologists will dig us up in 2 million years, and they'll claim that we worship the, you know, Shiba Dog.
Right. Yeah. All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week, one I've recommended before, and one I would read more than once, read often, Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. And I bring this up because it might have a little...
Oh my God, it's like my favorite book of last year, Andy. Yeah. You know it. I talk to you about it all the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has a little bit of bearing on some of the upcoming stories we're going to be talking about later on in the episode, but... it's a sci-fi story. It takes place in the future, the year 2044. Like most of humanity, Wade Watts escapes his grim surroundings by spending his waking hours jacked into the Oasis, a sprawling virtual utopia that lets you be anything you want to be, a place where you can live and play and fall in love on any of 10,000 planets, very similar to Second Life currently. Like most of humanity, Wade dreams of being the one to discover the ultimate lottery ticket that lies concealed within the virtual world. Somewhere inside the giant network playground, the creator of Oasis, James Halliday, has hidden a series of fiendish puzzles that will yield massive fortune and remarkable power to whoever can unlock them.
Well, it sounds like Bitcoin money.
Kind of. But it's more like the book is really like a basically like a big treasure hunt, like a big
scavenger hunt. You know, it's like it's almost like you had a massive social media network that was somehow tied to virtual reality and yet completely gamified. It's almost like that.
Yeah.
Which leads me to wonder what could possibly be like that in the real world.
Well, I think
what could possibly achieve this level of pervasiveness in our lives.
Do I detect some foreshadowing here?
I don't know. I mean, MySpace is coming back.
Friendster.
Exactly.
If
you guys haven't read this book, it's fantastic. I've read it. I got it for Christmas.
Yeah.
It's the kind of book that you're gonna keep on turning the pages. The concepts are there. If you like technology, you're going to be into them because they're not so far out there that you can't imagine it. And after reading it, I'm looking at the book right now. After reading it, you kind of want to be there. You kind of understand. Yeah. And the best part about it is that the Oasis, it's so culturally relevant to anyone who spent any time on a classic Nintendo or in an arcade.
Right.
So
right.
If you're anywhere between the ages of like 40 and 20, you're gonna get this book.
Yeah,
you're gonna get it, and you're gonna say wow, and it's gonna make you want to jump and check out some of that older stuff.
Particularly, if you grew up in the 80s, it's a total nostalgia dump.
Exactly, and I believe Will Wheaton reads this version of the book.
That
if you're gonna
correct.
Hear the audio side.
Yep.
And Will Wheaton does a great job of kind of pulling you in, and also, you know, Will Wheaton. Child of the 80s, you know, in the 90s, you know, he kind of hit it big in 1988 with his first appearance on or 1987 with his first appearance on Starship: The Next Generation, and he kind of leaned into the geek he is ever since. So it's a great book. Audible's done a great job. The production is great. But if you're not in, you definitely should check it out. It's a good story. It's well written.
He embodies the character of Wade Watts so perfectly, so appropriately. So to download that free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Plus a 30-day trial to check out their service. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you still get to keep the book for free. And what a book to keep for free. It's a terrific book. Plus, there are over 100,000 titles at Audible to choose from, so you don't have to pick that book. You can pick something else, and that'll be yours for free. It's a great book, though. I highly recommend it. I believe that there's a movie adaptation in the works.
Oh, God.
Did you not know that?
I mean, I imagined it might have happened, but if anything, a video game adaptation would be the most appropriate thing.
I can definitely see that, too. I can definitely see that, too. Because it is the book kind of reads like a video game as you're with him playing it.
Yeah, it's just so good. We're going to get into some of the details of Ready Player One when we come back from the break.
And when we come back, also, the president wants to overhaul NSA collection. But is it just more smoke and mirrors? Take a listen to this and come on back. A perfect snowflake, our needle in the hay. A four-leaf clover on a lovely summer's day. Let's end a sweet day, our dreams are coming true. One in a million, that is you. A glistening diamond, our bright and shining pearl. A shooting star above a rainbow, that's our girl. It's a sweet and our dreams are coming true. One in a million, that is you. Our search was long, our search was hard, but we would not give up. Now here you are. Don't this could be your home. You If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and our guest, Greg Davies of the Blendover podcast. As reported in the New York Times this week, the Obama administration is preparing to unveil a legislative proposal for a far-reaching overhaul of the National Security Agency's once-secret bulk phone records program in a way that, if approved by Congress, would end the aspect that is the most alarmed privacy advocates since its existence was leaked last year, according to senior administration officials. Under the proposal, they said, the NSA would end its systematic collection of data about Americans' calling habits. The bulk records would stay in the hands of phone companies, which would not be required to retain the data for any longer than they normally would. And the NSA could obtain specific records only with permission from a judge, using a new kind of court order. Well, that sounds like it will solve many of the problems that a lot of privacy advocates had with that system.
I think it's kind of like the heads I win, tails you lose scenario, really. Because, okay, on the one hand, you know, the NSA was like, you got to make a haystack if you want to find the needle in the haystack. And, you know, someone could argue that that's, you know, a thing. But the fact is, I think what's worrisome here is that, you know, it was leaked that they're tracking the phone metadata because the companies get rid of it. The companies say they get rid of it because it'd be too onerous to hold it. It's not too onerous to hold it. Holding data is getting easier and easier by the minute. So I don't know that after 18 months, when a phone company says its records are lost or they're gone, the government won't be able to get their hands on them, because I do think there'll be a backup somewhere. I go to my own AT&T like login, and I can see phone calls I've made, you know, 2 years ago. So that's 24 months.
Yeah.
Then there's just the fact that it's not simply the collection of phone metadata that is worrisome. It is the collection of everything that's worrisome. And the overreaching hand that has hacked into or requested access of or requested the encryption keys to multiple regularly used online services is really the problem. The idea that they're like, you know, when Mark Zuckerberg is calling up the president saying, you got to stop this. It's messing with me. It's messing with my business. It's messing with the whole idea of the internet being free. You're supposed to be the technological president. What the heck's going on here? You know, the president comes back and says, okay, Mark, you're upset about Facebook and the fact that we're collecting this data. I'm going to stop the phone records. Right? It doesn't actually translate because the information that's really, really, really granular is coming from online activity. We're talking less and less on the phone. How often are you speaking on the telephone, that your cell phone, your mobile phone, your smartphone? The phone app is probably one of the least used apps on that thing, or especially in terms of time. So you might access it every once, you know, more often than not, but the actual time spent using it is going to be way less than some of the apps we talked about before, like 2048 or Instagram or Facebook or whatever. So the idea that they're going to stop this whole phone thing and say, okay, we've done it, we've stopped the phone thing, it's just not enough. It's a step in the right direction, but they need to really kind of come at this from a holistic perspective and say, you know, we're going to stop the phone thing. We're looking into what's up with the online thing. And, you know, hacking into companies or having companies shut down because they won't give you the encryption key and they're not even able to say, hey, look, the government wants the encryption key to your email messages for fear of getting thrown in jail. Now, that's some scary tactic shit. Yeah. And that's the kind of stuff that needs to stop. At the very least, people should be able to go in front of the FISA court themselves and represent their own companies and or be able to say when a FISA request has come their way. And I know many will say, well, the terrorists get an update. The terrorists will know that, you know, the FISA court is after the data here. They'll stop using that service. You know, it's awful to say it, but part of the whole freedom thing is the risk in making sure that all your stuff is private. You have to just trust that people want to live in a society where their stuff is private, so they're going to take the actions they need to take in order to make sure that they're not going to give up those privacies to fall under the types of worlds these terrorists want to live in.
Greg?
Well, I can tell you that this whole announcement from Barack Obama is nothing more than just a scripted PR deal that's just absolute nonsense.
Lip service?
Oh, absolute nonsense. Because the real deal is not really the new laws that were put in place by the NSA between the Patriot Act and today. The real laws were put in place through executive order by Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, specifically Executive Order 12333, of which I brought to the show, and I've added the link in the show notes so you can throw that into the links for the people.
Absolutely.
And this was written in, like, the 80s. 2.3 is the section in particular with the collection of information. Agencies within the intelligence community are authorized to collect, retain, or disseminate information concerning U.S. persons only in accordance with procedures established by the head of the agency concerned and approved by the Attorney General. In other words, they only need the AG's approval on this. Consistent with the authorities provided in Part 1 of the order, these procedures shall permit collection, retention, and dissemination of the following types of information. A is the important section here. Information that is publicly available or collected with the consent of the person concerned. Now, when Ronald Reagan wrote this back in the 80s, there wasn't a Facebook. You didn't have to sign a terms of service agreement. But the information you provide to services like Facebook, Twitter, Google, pick your service, that's all open game still. This whole surveillance system, unacceptable, unconstitutional. It needs to end, period.
How do we square unconstitutional against the president's constitutional right to push an executive order? Like that's something that only the Supreme Court can really talk, because they're basically the Supreme Court then has to say, we as one co-equal branch of government say that your co-equal branch of government has overstepped its bounds, its legal rights. That to me seems like a political a political mountain that's going to be hard to summit.
It's a political shitstorm, I know. I mean, George Washington even had his own executive orders, and it's a part of the system. You know, I'm not arguing against.
Well, we're not arguing against executive orders. Yeah. Yet. It's like this one is overreaching. I don't disagree that this one. I don't disagree that this one is being used in a manner that is inconsistent with its drafting and its spirit, frankly. Maybe the Constitution has to be amended to say that these presidential executive orders must be reviewed, or maybe they expire. I mean, it's 30 years after Reagan, right? It's 30 years after after Reagan's first term ended. Reagan's first term ended in 84. We're here in 2014. The world has changed, right? And it's important to scrutinize the kinds of acts that are done there. I mean, even right now, Republicans are trying to get rid of some of the laws Reagan pushed in regarding the fact that a hospital has to help somebody if they end up on their doorstep bleeding.
Sure.
Well, that seems to be right on
here. The NSA hearings and the surveillance hearings that have been held in Washington that have been covered by C-SPAN but nowhere else, Richard Clark himself has stated on the record that a vast majority of phone call information and internet information has been collected by the NSA under Executive Order 12333. The new laws have nothing to do with it. It's all smoke and mirrors. It's all this executive order. This is the problem. The problem is that the executive order was created in the mind of a non-digital era, before the time when you would sign off your rights or to use a service such as...
Right, no, I completely agree. This is why I'm saying that it should be reviewed, because now it's being used in a manner that is inconsistent with both its draft, with its drafted purpose and its spirit, right? Like, no one was thinking about this. I mean, obviously, you might have given some information to AT&T about where you live and so on and so forth. So whatever, right? AT&T's been around for 100 years, too. But the idea that you'd have a billion people, or at least 150 million Americans, sitting on a service and voluntarily giving information about the most intimate aspects of their lives, and the NSA can tap into that, that's not what they meant.
Right. It's nothing to do with that, though. It's the principle of the matter. As a citizen or resident, in my case, of the United States, you have the right to privacy, and you don't have to, you know, the whole argument about
anyone on United States soil has the right to privacy. You don't even have to be, unless you're a prisoner in a prison, as long as you're on soil, you have the right to privacy. It's crazy.
Right, exactly. But the thing is, the argument that's very pervasive across the United States, though it is starting to die out, is that if you're not doing anything wrong, then you have nothing to hide. And that argument is slowly dying, which is good to see.
Why don't you tell us why that argument has a false premise, why it, in fact, is ridiculous?
You don't have anything to hide? Tell me what your social security number is or your credit card number.
Oh, no, I'm not asking you because I'm challenging you. I'm asking you to make it clear to the audience why the idea that I have nothing.
Exactly. I'm playing with you here. I'm just basically giving you the example of, like, if you say you have nothing to hide, then tell me what your credit card number is.
Right.
You know, for me, there's certain information, and I mean, this goes beyond the thing that you had an embarrassing experience 3 years ago and you'd rather not talk about it and keep it private. It's as individuals that are living and working in this country, there are certain things within the economy and with employment that you would regard as confidential, and therefore it is imperative that you regard that as private information. I don't want financial information to be available to the NSA for any reason. I don't want my health records available.
Well, let's not forget corruption too.
Yeah,
when a government has access to all this information, agents within that government may use the information for nefarious purposes. Not only enriching themselves through, you know, selling information to somebody in the Middle East or something like that, but also just by blackmail, by saying, hey, look, you're a candidate, you're going up against the guy that I like, or someone's paid me because you're going up against a candidate that they like, and we're going to say that we have this information on you. There's a picture of you kissing in a same-sex makeout session with somebody, And, you know, maybe you're okay with that personally, but maybe your constituents aren't, yada, yada, yada. For me, you look at this country, especially with the religious take that it has, and there are many people that employ, you know, that go through actions that their stated religious affiliation is not comfortable with. And, you know, there's a lot of like, well, in my youth, I did X, Y, and Z, and A, B, and C. The fact that that could be used against you in the smallest terms, whether it's in your own community, in some sort of political situation where you're running for an office, or just in terms of like your ability to get a job, the stupid little thing you did is just as important to you perhaps as your financial information, your social security information, all these things. That's the fundamental piece of privacy to me that matters. The fact that an individual can live a life without fear of being exposed of those things in which they wish not to be exposed of.
Agreed.
Regardless of what they are.
Absolutely agreed. But in the larger political spectrum of things, I can't help but think that those, including myself, who were rather supportive of Barack Obama before he became president of the United States, must feel somewhat disillusioned with this president at this stage. Mm. He ran the whole campaign on hope and change. And in the years since he's had his presidency, we have seen him issue the least amount of pardons in the United States, out of all presidents. He is also responsible for the prosecution of the most whistleblowers out of any president combined in the history of the United States. Not to mention that he's also responsible for the droning of a United States citizen without due process. On top of that, we've now got him standing on a pedestal talking about how he's fucking saving the day by telling the NSA, no, no, touchy phone calls. How about this? Fuck your hope. Fuck your change. Stop being a dick.
Yeah, I mean, the political situation regarding Barack Obama is really interesting. On the one hand, he's a liberal Democrat. And in order to make sure that he can push some of his agenda through, it's very clear to me that he wants to be able to stand on data when he's talking to his political rivals.
Let me just emphasize real quick. It did sound like I was like, Barack, 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 it's all you. It's not just all him. He's a figurehead. He's the face. There's other people behind the scenes that pull the strings and sway opinion and sway decisions.
Sure, but in the end, it's his name that's on the front of that. He's the captain of the ship, and you know, Ronald Reagan did the things that he thought were necessary, even though his advisor said he was crazy. When it came to the Cold War, I think Barack Obama, and you know, to a greater extent possibly than George W. Bush before him, is also kind of at the helm here with his own thoughts and processes, thinking that he's, you know, in some ways obviously he's constrained by stuff, just like Ronald Reagan was forced to accept Martin Luther King Day as a holiday. Barack Obama's been forced to accept certain political realities. But I do think that one of the reasons why we see, and this is not to defend him, this is just to say, like, in terms of the political situation surrounding the technology piece that we're talking about, he has done these things which go against the whole hope, whatever, the kind of like glossy blue sky world that we all felt in like throughout 2008, mm-hmm. because he has certain things he wants to push through, and he wants to be able to say, well, when you look at the actual data, these political enemies of mine are wrong, because I'm actually deporting more people than that. I'm actually cutting down whistleblowers. I'm actually not as liberal as you think, because I'm going hardcore, whatever. But on the one side, I'm going to get these things through. Now, for me, the big thing that ties back into technology here is that the reason this law has changed, or is going to change, or this bill has been introduced, is because of revelations by Edward Snowden in the year 2013.
Oh, yeah.
So to me, that says that Edward Snowden, I'm not going to use the term one, I'm not going to use the term whatever, but he's managed to influence the most powerful office on the face of the earth.
It's just a PR thing. They can still.
It is, though, but they've had to pivot from their original position, they've had to address this from a PR perspective, because this man came out and said this. Now, there's a national conversation going that, frankly, would not have happened. The press would not be on. That just could not have happened if Edward Snowden hadn't come out with this stuff.
Yeah.
Does that change the perspective of the nation on Edward Snowden and what he's been able to reveal? And in the face of this Crimea thing, does it help him or hurt him? the fact that the president had to come out and actually say something about him. And frankly, oddly enough, the whole entire speech avoided the terms Edward and Snowden. Right,
yeah. Well, you got to remember as well, I don't think Edward Snowden's story is over yet. I still think he's got a lot more ammunition up his sleeve. I think we're going to see more of him in the coming year. That being said, though, I think the real thing that we as forerunners in the tech community, at the very least, as your early adopters, as the people who are influencers on the web, we should really not be encouraging people to look at NSA phone surveillance. We should be pushing people towards 1-2-3-3. Get them to memorize that. That's your executive order that needs to be fixed, because it wasn't written for this era. It needs to be changed or overhauled, because that is the key that's giving the NSA and the CIA all the power in the world to dig up anything on you, anything.
Yeah, no, it's so true. I think that the eyes have to be focused on all the regulations that are associated with the type of behavior that we're not happy with. And if 1-2-3-3-3 is this big deal, then I think that has to be attacked. It has to be attacked with the same sort of fire that SOPA and PIPA were attacked with. You hear Mark Zuckerberg writing to the president saying this is not cool. But you don't see the same outrage that people used when they were talking about the idea that Congress could simply restrict a website on the internet because somebody complained about it. That SOPA and PIPA stuff from last year, that's the kind of fervor that the tech community probably needs to employ if they want to limit the reach of the intelligence agencies. That's the kind of stuff they have to pull out and say, look, we're going to turn off the Wikipedia for a day because you may have entered something on here that the NSA thinks is a dissent, and they might use that against you later. Stuff like that.
My skepticism tells me, though, that I don't think we're going to see that for a long while. And the reason for that is because there's been so many events over the last 2 years since that blackout that have warranted a similar reaction from certain organizations that have really drawn nothing but silence. Recently, Andy was on Blendover, and we talked about earlier in the show the whole thing about Netflix versus Comcast. That really stemmed from a judge overturning an element of net neutrality. And he brought that particular story to the show. And our argument was, where's the EFF in this? And we went and checked their website live. Absolutely nothing to say about it. Where's Wikipedia on this? Where are all these other websites? Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook. Where are all these organizations that were so active? Reddit. Where was Reddit? Nowhere. So I think what we're seeing is, and I'm not so sure whether it's organizationally based, although we can certainly say that of the EFF. I think what we're seeing is that...
the chairman of the FCC did come out and say that he was going to attempt multiple ways to get around the judge's ruling. That is to say, he was looking for alternatives to the way the judge looked at it in order to possibly have the case retried or to get Congress to ratify new legislation into law that would allow the FCC to have this kind of control.
Right. You're right. You're absolutely right about that. But I think what we're seeing is an element of digital fatigue on the part of the people online. There's, and I think a lot of it stems from nonchalance. Like, why bother? It's just going to happen anyway. They're going to take this shit away from us anyway. Why should we do anything about it? There's a lack of motivation. And a lot of it, and this is another concept that we've discussed on this show before, and that is the simplification of a cause. The concept of net neutrality and NSA phone surveillance is not as such a simple, divisive debate as, say, the issue of gay marriage, where you've got one side or the other. And
it's harder to market.
Yeah, and the problem that we've got with this is that, it's very difficult to simplify and rally the troops. I think we're getting closer now that people are starting to point out Executive Order 1-2-3-3-3. I mean, 1-2-3-3-3, you can come up with a jingle for that. 1-2-3-3-3, stop that shit. Or whatever, you know, you could come up with something.
That's our new theme song. That's going to be it. 1-2-3-3-3, stop that shit.
I feel like the real issue here is getting everyone behind, building a presence behind a 35-year-old executive order versus events that have taken place within the last year. It's really hard to sort of.
We got to get some big booty hoes in front. Five of them. 1-2-3-3-3. Put on their booty.
You've got to make it a clear and present issue.
And it's all hot and it's happening on football. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because people are going to be like, why should we change something that's this old? They may not even be aware of it, you know. So it's basically about building the presence in people's
exactly.
minds.
Exactly.
Forget 1-2-3-3-3.
Yeah, there you go. You know, along those lines. You know,
executive order 1-2-3-3-3. There you go.
Yeah. So yeah, look it up yourself, folks, and I'm sure Andy will add in the link in the show notes.
Absolutely.
And you can have a look at the full text, but I've the link that I've created is it goes directly to section 2.3 where the pertinent information is. It essentially just needs to be replaced and updated. Now, no one's arguing that our intelligence services shouldn't do what they've done for years and do their espionage techniques abroad. You know, there's certain elements about that that are essential for national.
Well, if it worked, I mean, let's face it, the CIA for the last 10 years has given us bunk on what's happening. They told the president that and the national security staff that, hey, look, there's like pretty much no chance Putin's going to go into the Ukraine. Right. They just get it wrong. There was a time when the president used to call up CNN for data on what bombs fell. Now,
well, just
you go to Twitter.
Just to clarify, though, the whole thing about Ukraine, I hate to be correcting you on this, but we need to be clear. It's still not clear, according to the diverse reports that are coming out of both Russia and the United States, whether those troops are indeed from Russia that are in Crimea at the moment. The troops.
Fine, yes, you're saying that the annexation and the political moves.
The referendum that was put in place, they had a choice between returning to Russia or independence. If they went back to independence, they would have reverted under control to Turkey based on a centuries-old treaty that was signed by Catherine the Great in the Ottoman Empire. It just wouldn't work for them, so they chose Russia.
Because they didn't have any other choice. But bottom line is that the CIA is no longer the sort of super technologically super savvy organization that it used to be. There was a time when you went online and the CIA World Factbook was where you went to learn everything you could. There was a time when the CIA were the guys who were basically the guys who gave you news on the ground about everything. And the fact is, the CIA, whose main mission is to provide intelligence, has pivoted in an extraordinary way to flying drones and killing people. Instead of actually giving us actionable intelligence, which is like their mandate, which is why, like, when you watch a great TV show like The Americans and you see the CIA working with the FBI with little tiny devices and taking pictures and snapshots and doing all this stuff, you're like, that's where their focus isn't right now.
Exactly. Yeah.
I can't dream about technology. I can't have wonderful technology dreams anymore.
There's too
much
rivalry between the organizations. I mean, right now, the CIA, publicly that we know of, they're mainly focused in areas such as countries in Africa. They're most definitely involved with what's going on in Syria. And of course, you know, there's other areas in the world that they're involved with as well. But the real focus here, we're kind of going off the rails a little bit, you know, just to bring it back to the focus, is that the issue is the NSA, in a very real way, that the East Germans had to suffer under the Stasi, are placing United States citizens under surveillance. This is not acceptable. It's unconstitutional.
Yes, yes, unconstitutional. Absolutely. Well, 1-2-3-3. 1-2-3-3-3. Everyone will remember it by the end of this podcast.
Yeah, we need to come.
They're going to remember. They're going to remember 1-2-3-3-3. Is that what they're going
to
remember?
1-2-3-3-3. Don't dial it. Just tell them to stop it.
Executive order 1-2-3-3-3.
Yeah.
It might as well have been Executive Order 666 in Star Wars.
Execute Order 12333. No. Doesn't have the same ring, but, you know.
Let's move on to the next story here. We've spent plenty of time on 12333. Pando Daily has discovered confidential internal Google and Apple memos that clearly show that what began as a secret cartel agreement between Steve Jobs and Eric Schmidt to illegally fix the labor market for high-tech workers expanded within a few years to include companies ranging from Dell, IBM, eBay, Microsoft, Comcast, Clear Channel, DreamWorks, London PR company WPP. All told, the combined workforces of the companies involved totals of well over a million employees. These agreements prompted a Department of Justice investigation, resulting in a settlement in which the companies agreed to curb their restricted hiring deals. The same companies were then hit with a civil suit by employees affected by the agreements. Although the DOJ decided to focus its attention on just Apple, Google, Intel, Intuit, Lucasfilm, and Pixar, the emails and memos clearly named dozens more companies, which, at least as far as Google and Apple execs were concerned, formed part of their wage-fixing cartel. This all began back in March 2005, a few weeks after Steve Jobs threatened Google's Sergey Brin to stop all recruiting at Apple. He said, "If you hire a single one of these people, that means war." Amongst Google's documents, a cryptic warning suggests that across all industries, illegal non-solicitation agreements were common everywhere. Quote, "Please be cautious when recruiting teams from any company to keep our candidates and potential employees safe from legal action. Most companies have non-solicit agreements, which would limit or prohibit a candidate from asking a coworker to interview with us as well." That passage alone is a stunning example of not just flagrantly illegal practices. It shows how few rights companies assume their employees are entitled to, rights that Americans take for granted, such as the right to free speech, assembly, the right to ask one's own coworker if he or she would be interested in taking a better job somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting because the entire country is kind of moving toward this space where the people who run business, the people who run government, are working pretty diligently to limit the ability of workers to you know, effectively chase down the market or unionize in order to change the market. And that's interesting because this happened, you know, technology is often ahead of the normal curve, and this happened in 2005. What was happening in 2005? Online services were becoming huge. Apple was moving into the cloud, you know, just in terms of its conceptually. It wouldn't happen until, 2010. But, you know, they're ramping up and they're building all these things. And here Google is, you know, trying to be at the cloud, and they're clearly chasing down the same talent. Now, part of this might very well be an instance of character. Steve Jobs starts this conversation by talking about this means war. You're Sergey, Eric, or Larry, and you're like, well, what can we do to avert war with Apple? Because they've got a lot more money than we do. And they get into these conversations only because Steve Jobs is the kind of person who cares less about the law, frankly, and honestly, then he cares about getting his way. I'm not going to lie. Steve Jobs is a brilliant man, but this idea of the asshole who can be an asshole because he's talented is one that we've really got to get away from as a society, because it's not about individuals. It's about – I mean, individualism is important, but not at the expense of other people's rights, and that's what we have here. So it's interesting to see that this information came out, and it also just goes to show that – we need to be vigilant about, as technologists, mm-hmm. you know, we're making magic happen, right? Yeah. The idea that you can look at your telephone and find out what happened across the world or just get a message from somebody, that's all happening. It's reliable. It's all happening because there are people who are thinking and solving these problems, and they're valued, and they need to be valued appropriately. So when we see these huge acquisitions and so forth and acqui-hires and all that, you know, it's not, it sounds crazy, but for a lot of the time, like, only so many people in the world can actually pull this off, can actually do this kind of work. And the idea that we limit them and limit their ability to earn is kind of crazy from a free market perspective. And I'm just kind of happy that the situation has gotten scrutiny. I just wish it got a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's done because of insecurity, because of a lack of confidence that you'll be able to replace that worker with somebody equally as competent.
Right, but outing the companies that were involved in a more public manner, like having this in the mainstream media, this is the kind of thing, I mean, documents revealed by Edward Snowden show up all the time. Documents revealed from stealing jobs show whatever. Now, I know there's a big thing in our society, don't speak ill of the dead, yada, 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 but there's a legacy that we have to, you know, we have to remove about,
sure.
You know, there's aspects of the legacy that have to be corrected for the record. And this is one of them, publicly and openly. This is shitty. Now, you don't take away from anyone's achievements, but this is clearly a piece of Steve Jobs' personality. And I repeat that, his personality that drove this kind of thinking, and people just kind of went along. Sort of like when James Cameron wants to make a movie about blue people and people just kind of go along.
These documents that Pan O'Daly have, these weren't hacked from anywhere, right? They were basically court documents.
Yeah, they were court documents that had been – they basically sifted through publicly available court documents.
It was
documents.
Part of a document production. Yeah. So the system says that when the Justice Department – or when I sue you, I'm going to ask you for documents relevant to our suit. You have to give them to me. And you can ask for me for this, and I have to – this is, and that's a document production. These documents are part of those.
Well, I find it interesting that if you go right to the very end of the article, a spokesman for AMD declined to comment on this story. A spokesman for AOL declined to comment on this story. A spokesman for Singular AT&T declined to comment for this story. A spokesperson for Dell declined to comment for this story. Blah, 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 all the way through. There's no surprise there. This is...
way of saying something without having to say something.
Yeah,
right? it's all those companies. It's a wonderful way to do it.
It's a wage fixing deal, and it's illegal. But I personally really don't have any opinion on this either way, except for that it does limit the idea of competition within the companies in terms of being able to headhunt and find people that would be better suited to certain other. Departments within companies, if you will.
For me, it's a big deal because the fact is, you know, my parents came to this country because they wanted the mobility to go where they wanted to go when they wanted to go there, knowing that they could shuck and jive and make a better way for themselves. They could sell themselves. They can say, I have these skills. I can do this. And based on my resume, record, whatever, you're going to pay me commensurate with that. Instead of saying, I have these skills, but because you guys have a lot of money and because you run these companies, I'm going to just kind of like take what you're going to give me. I mean, that's a huge problem. That's a problem that affects minorities all over this country. It's a problem that affects women especially, that because you're not in this class, you don't get to actually control your destiny. And that, to me, is the big issue here. It's a fundamental step backward from what technology is supposed to do, which is to free us all, enable us to do what we want to do for a living. Instead, you get locked into your company because Steve Jobs wants you to work on this project, even though you'd love to work for that project. But the fact is, the money they're going to give you is a price fixed amount, so you're disincentivized to actually chase that down.
Michael Dell's email to Eric Schmidt in that article is a classic, by the way. It's lol worthy. So have a look at that, folks, in the show notes.
Yeah, it's totally worth looking through this article and the preceding article where they actually did some of the discovery. I think it was called the Tectopus. So both of those articles are worth checking out, and I'll put the link for those in the show notes. According to a report in the Wall Street Journal, Apple is in talks with Comcast about teaming up for a streaming TV service that would use Apple set-top box and get special treatment on Comcast cables to ensure it bypasses congestion on the web, people familiar with the matter say. Discussions between Apple and Comcast are still in the early stages and hurdles remain. But if the deal would mark a new level of cooperation and integration between a tech company and a cable provider to modernize TV viewing, Apple's intention is to allow users to stream live and on-demand TV programming and digital video recording stored in the cloud, effectively taking the place of traditional set-top box. Their goal is to ensure that users don't see hiccups in the service or buffering that can take place while streaming web video, making the video the same quality as Comcast's TV transmissions to normal set-top boxes.
Now we actually hit this last episode on the drill down. Before it was reported, we speculated about what it really meant to have an Apple TV.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
One of the things that we came down with after just some thinking out loud was the fact that it's not about a TV. It's about a service. I think I said that Apple needs to buy Comcast or get in really good with them in order to have a true Apple TV experience. And lo and behold, a week later, that's exactly what seems to be happening.
Right. It's not about the device. It's about the content deals. And we're seeing that clearly in this deal with Comcast.
Mm-hmm. And if you own an Apple TV, you've noticed that over time, more and more different quote-unquote channels or apps have shown up on that particular device's interface. That's Apple closing deals with different companies. Now they want to streamline that through a Comcast. And that's what's necessary in order for them to pull that off. So if you like hearing news before it happens, show up here.
Yeah, the Drill Down and the Blend Over podcast, I got to say, we're pretty advanced in breaking the news before anyone else. So, yeah, I agree with you, Dwayne.
We're so modest.
We're crazy modest people on this show. That's what we are.
Any thoughts on the Comcast Apple deal here, Greg?
Oh, not really, aside from the fact that it's inevitable. I mean, this kind of stuff is going to happen. Yeah. I mean, Netflix is ruling the roost at the moment, and you've got their competitors, Amazon Prime and Hulu Plus and, you know, other services out there that seem to be doing reasonably well. This was the inevitable result of moving into the 21st century, and that was decentralizing ownership of entertainment and enabling it to be screened in a fashion that makes it available to everyone. I think there's a lot of companies playing catch-up, notably Hollywood companies and record labels, the entertainment industry overall. But the
southern part of California that controls entertainment and content does not communicate effectively with the northern part of California
that controls
technology. Yeah, that's like the thing that I think we get out of this the most.
They just have a rumble like 1950s style, get the Warriors out.
It's coming, though. It's coming for sure.
Yeah.
Because it's inevitable.
The big thing here is that, for me at least, is that I would like to see more decentralization. I'd like to see more content being created by independent people, et cetera. But what we're seeing is Comcast trying to get with Time Warner after purchasing NBC. So effectively, Comcast will have NBC, Universal, all this content in addition to HBO and all the stuff that Comcast wants to further gain, and we'll have a complete centralization because Comcast is, now they know their model, I'm going to provide pipes to you, is not powerful enough. They're chasing down what people actually want, the content.
Yeah,
and they're
gold rush is what they're doing.
Right. So they're chasing down this content and they're looking at it and they're saying, we want a way to lock that down. That's why Apple's talking to them, because Apple sees that could be an issue. Now, Apple is all about, Apple's all about looking at trends where people want to, bring straight up innovation and efficiency to a space. And then they try to figure out a way to slow it down and marry that efficiency with the existing infrastructure. That's what happened with iTunes. That's what happens with paying for the video rentals and all that stuff. That's what's happening here. They want the TV, but they want to work through a Comcast because they want to know that they've got legitimacy and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. It's a little strange because, what is this going to mean for the Rokus of the world and other guys? I just don't know. I don't like the idea. Apple has a bad history of trying to consolidate a market. And frankly, when it comes to wage disputes, books, all this stuff, to not playing by the rules, of an open, of an open marketplace. They want to kind of lock things down and control it. Now, I have Apple products. I like Apple, but that's just something that I'm keenly aware of and that we should all be looking out for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Apple is sort of like the 800-pound gorilla in the room because they've already had the established content deals on the music side and also on the movie side with iTunes rentals. So I mean they're swinging around their clout in basically any new venue that they can.
Apple is waving their dicks in the wind.
But it's not even that new a venue is my whole thing. You know, Netflix has been around, everything, you know, for people holding their own stuff. Yeah. Plex has been around. These things have been around. Apple comes in late and isn't innovating. They're kind of normalizing, right? Yeah. We want to make this something that everyone can get to. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And by in order to do that, we have to kind of like go pull it back a second. So you get services that are reasonable, but not on the cutting edge. You know, that's kind of what we see here. And I just want everyone to be aware of that. It's not like the second coming when Apple shows up. It's kind of like, okay, well, it'll be somewhat legitimized, and you know, Comcast will get a lot of its way, and eventually they'll get angry at Apple for having a better deal than they thought they did. Is kind of what I think we tend to see in these spaces. But again, Apple doesn't necessarily play by the rules. I mean, they would say they always play by the rules, but it's always coming out a little sketchy, right? Like, more often than not, people are like, wait a minute, that whole book thing was weird. Wait a minute, this whole labor thing was weird. Wait a minute, the whole tax thing was weird. Apple comes across as a little, you know, you just have to watch them.
Yep, yep, yep. Absolutely, absolutely. It's interesting that you mentioned the labor thing that we just talked about before and the tax thing, which we had talked about previously. Their divertment of funds through Ireland and Sweden, I think it is, that funny sort of arrangement that they have to save on taxes. Okay, so this is the huge big news of the week. Just happened today, I think, as we record on Wednesday. Facebook has announced plans to purchase Oculus VR, the company behind the Rift headset, for about $2 billion in cash and stock. That includes $400 million and 23.1 million Facebook shares. An additional $300 million earnout will be paid in cash and stock if Oculus hits specific milestones. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said, "I'm excited to announce we've agreed to acquire Oculus VR. Our mission is to make the world more open and connected. For the past few years, this has mostly meant building mobile apps. We have a lot to do, more to do on mobile, but at this point, we feel we're in a position where we can start focusing on platforms that will come next to enable even more useful, entertaining, and personal experiences." Zuckerberg says that their efforts with Oculus will continue to focus on gaming initially, but after gaming, they're going to expand into a variety of other arenas. He says, "We were going to make Oculus a platform for many other experiences. Imagine enjoying a courtside seat at a game, studying in a classroom of students and teachers all over the world, or consulting with a doctor face-to-face just by putting on your goggles in your home. It's a really new communication platform," he says. "By feeling truly present, you can share unbounded spaces and experiences with the people in your life. Imagine sharing not just moments with your friends online, but entire experiences and adventures. At first glance, it may not seem obvious why Oculus is partnering with Facebook. But when you consider it more carefully, we're culturally aligned with a focus on innovating and hiring the best and brightest. We believe communication drives new platforms, and we want to contribute to a more open, connected world. And we both see virtual reality as the next step." I don't know. I heard about this news, and first of all, let me just say that this completely took me by surprise. I did not see this coming at all. Secondly, I couldn't figure out exactly what Facebook would, what purpose they would have with purchasing a VR helmet company. And then like the immediate first thought is ads, of course. It's a new venue to sell ad space.
Well,
I don't know. I feel like the first thing that you thought, Andy, after you were surprised, was a level of disappointment. I think you felt that. I know, yeah. I felt that. I know our buddy Davinja felt that. Yeah. A level of disappointment around the fact that
Oculus started as a Kickstarter, as a homegrown, supported, user-supported project.
that happened to have a wonderful idea, wonderful technology, and it got so big, in fact, that the guy who is the guru of independent gaming, John Carmack of ID Software, the guy behind titles like Wolfenstein 3D, Quake, Doom, and all their sequels, with the exception of Quake 4, he signed on to Oculus to say, this is so good, I'm going to move into here. I'm gonna work with you. I've made my money. I'm a wealthy man. I have legacy. But what you're doing is ecstatic, and frankly, it reminds me of myself when I was just starting out. He moved into that space, and then suddenly, and granted, you know, the stock goes way up when that happens, suddenly the guy behind independent gaming is now an employee of Mark Zuckerberg, which I think made all of us shocked, and that's where the disappointment comes in. We've got new 8th-generation video game consoles showing up. Microsoft with its Kinect interface, Sony with its new VR interface, Steambox is yet to come, and I'm not even going to talk about Nintendo because God knows. But Oculus seemed like it could have a home somewhere in the next age of modern gaming. What Facebook wants is something possibly more immersive than that, more immersive than just an entertainment experience that you put on and take off. So that's interesting here, but the implications are huge. And the technology world is up in arms. It's not a phrase I want to use often, but that's really what's going on here. They're confused and upset, and they don't understand. Mm-hmm. And the fact that a company like Oculus, which hasn't even released retail level hardware, is selling for, you know, just shy of 85% of the cost of, or 90% of the cost of the Nest company, which sells. To, you know, which is profitable and sells these amazing thermostats and protect devices and who knows what else is coming out. That company sells for $2.3 billion and Oculus sells for $2 billion. Both deals in cash and stock. It just kind of like makes you think about the wider, you know, thought of a tech bubble in addition to the fact that this is surprising because the company really isn't in a space where they're profitable at all.
I can understand where Dwayne's coming from there, because many, many years ago, there was a lot of metalheads that were very disappointed that Metallica cut their hair, and they were told that they were sold out. And essentially, that's what I'm kind of getting the feeling here. This is like the tech equivalent of selling out.
I don't think it's selling out. It's just surprising that someone who has a fundamentally different philosophy would move into this space. So it's not like they're not like, I don't think they're copying out. I think what Oculus will do with Facebook will probably be very interesting. Some people are really worried that the technology is going to die, as if it got acquired by Microsoft or something.
It is going to die, and I'll tell you why it's going to die. Facebook's aim here is not to Oculus will continue developing their VR game stuff, but Facebook's aim here really isn't the gaming. Facebook's game here is to come up with a competitor for Google Glass. That's what they're aiming for. They're aiming to have a competitive product that'll be out there and available for people down the line that will be a competitor against Google Glass. Both Google Glass and whatever this Facebook Oculus thing becomes is going to be absolutely useless. Now, we've had this argument before on the show, and let me just defend my position before we go down that route again. The three of us are early adopters. We like to jump into new things when they come out. However, my full-time job is tech support. I am on the front lines when, with the user base, your end user. So I see what
the muggles.
Yeah, what filters down from the early adopters all the way down to the end users, and there is no practical use for a Google Glass / Oculus product in the enterprise environment yet. There's no practical reason for it. It would be pointless. I mean, what are you going to do? Tell the fucking time? That's it, you know. So I think that's where Facebook is kind of going with this. However, what I will say is that what Google and Facebook are doing with this tech from a social media and mobile technology perspective is baby steps in the right direction. Mm-hmm. We need to get over this kind of eyewear thing into the next step, which I think eventually will be embedded technology such as contact lenses, in conjunction with gesture-based technology as opposed to touch or tactile tech. I think that's where we're going, but we're just not – we need to jump over these little hurdles first. As for the gaming perspective, The reading that I did, Andy, seemed to indicate that Facebook, even though they're acquiring the company, they're going to be very happy for Oculus to continue their independent work in and research into developing VR goggles specifically designed for gaming. So
that's the initial intent.
Yeah, so we'll see how that goes. Yeah. It depends, you know, how power hungry Zuckerberg is. But
exactly.
I think what he's going to do, what Facebook is going to do, is they're going to divert Oculus's energy at this point into developing some kind of mobile wear tech of some kind that will be a competitor for Google's device. That's where they're going with this.
I don't actually disagree with you at all. I think that this glass has to be mobile. Oculus is different in its immersive focus. It does allow you to immerse. So I think what we have here is Facebook looking at how to get. I mean, like, frankly, Facebook's competitor isn't so much just Google or just Microsoft or just Apple or whatever. Facebook's competitor is everything you do that's not Facebook.
Exactly.
You know, their competitor is people who don't want to waste their time on Facebook. If they can take the social media, the aspect of just kind of browsing on their site, looking at pictures and commenting on them, to the next level by immersing you in a situation, by creating a quote-unquote hangout that allows you to actually hang out with your friends while afar, interact with them on a more visceral virtual basis, that's going to go a really long way for them. So when you get in your house, you put on your goggles or whatever, you're gonna be in an actual room. You're really gonna be communicating. That could happen, but I do think in terms of the outside world, in terms of just being mobile, being out of the house, you know, obviously they have to get past battery issues and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
These visual displays, I think, just like smartwatches tied to a device that has lots of battery and space for multiple antennas and so on and so forth, and a cellular plan that you don't have to replicate onto a pair of glasses or a watch or whatever. That's where a lot of this is going. They're all going to have to move quickly. They're going to have to get lobbyists and stuff because Congress is already trying to pass laws against the use of such devices while driving, while doing whatever.
But I mean,
that's where they're going.
This at the beginning of the show, and that is where we are right now. Tech, as we know it, is really in its infancy. And what I'm noticing, the trend that I'm noticing through 2013 and into this year, is that we're looking at a lot of these companies, specifically Google and Facebook, jumping into and acquiring certain organizations that are focusing on that next generation tech. I mean, I referenced Dyson, which is the vacuum company that are now looking into robotics. But at the same time, Google acquires DARPA.
You know, Boston Dynamics. Boston Dynamics.
Exactly, Boston Dynamics. And Facebook has now acquired Oculus. We're looking at next generation technology that's not even ready yet. And even when it is ready, it's not going to be functionally usable or practical for the end users in, say, an enterprise setting. What we're looking at here is people trying to grab the next tech to control that next step innovation to get.
But the end user layout that you're dropping is interesting because I think ever since 2007, the idea that technology goes to the enterprise before it goes to the individual consumer has been flipped on its head. When Apple showed up with the iPhone, everyone was like, well, you know, BlackBerry's for enterprise, iPhones for people. Yeah. Then people started showing up and, you know, with their iPhones at work, IT people got upset. Eventually there was bring your own device to work, we'll hook it up, doesn't matter what it is, yada, yada, yada. I do think that there's actually going to be a market in the short term that allows for the types of technologies that, you know, in fact, maybe work doesn't want you to bring
for in. For attached technologies? Yes, I agree with you there. Because
I guess the technologies that work doesn't want you to even bring inside because you might have, you know, an idea of like recording all this shit is not necessarily good for your job depending on what it is.
What we're seeing at the moment, the trend that's beginning to shuffle down is the attached technologies, meaning devices that plug into your wirelessly, plug into your mobile device, whatever it may be. So there's some smartwatch applications out there that are basically third-party devices that connect via Bluetooth to your phone or, you know, other devices along those lines. And these Google Glasses and stuff like that would eventually probably do similar things to combat the battery problems and things like that. I do see an element of functionality there, but the real end game is total immersive technology, and that is your gesture-based technology, your contact lenses and embeddable augmented technologies, and also, you know, automation. It's coming. We're just seeing this is the embryonic stage, my friends. We should be more excited than what we were when we got on the internet for the first time, and even more excited than the first time we Googled porn.
Well, I mean, think about what this will do for porn. But another piece of this is that what we have is a world where, let's think about this. Instagram showed up, and within a couple of years, Instagram was purchased by Facebook for $1 billion. Yeah. Instagram was wildly popular, 30 million users. Product that was sound. It worked. It was out there, right? Nest showed up. Product that was sound. It worked. Sure. It was out there, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't being used by anywhere near 30 million people. Tumblr, you know, products not out there. This is, you know, Boston Dynamics even had, like, you know, it was making money. This is one of those things where you have a great idea, and let's not belittle anything or try to push people on the side. There's no reason not to get the money that you deserve for making the product that you made. There's no doubt. There's no hating on this front, right? You're not talking to people who are like, oh, man, it sucks. They don't even deserve that money, whatever. But we are seeing a consolidation of the internet. We're seeing a consolidation of this free reign of ideas and services into a few select companies that we talk about time and again: Google, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft. They're sucking it all up like a Dyson, because what they're doing is trying to steer history, obviously, but really, they're making sure in some ways that the other guys don't get these people, get this tech.
It's the patent wars all over again, but with
We're in like a cold war almost.
Yeah. Well, to a degree, there's also another element to this. And, like, you know, in the land of the blind, one eye is king. You know, and what you're looking at here is the organizations, your big organizations like your Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, etc. They're the big companies with all the resources and the capital behind them. And so they're going to get the lion's share of these developing tech enterprises that are coming out. That's inevitable. That's capitalism. That's going to happen.
You have to understand that when these guys showed up, everyone was like, okay, whatever. And then they got big. What I'm saying is that the ability to get big is becoming far more difficult.
Yeah, far more difficult.
You can't have an awesome, award-winning, chase-me-down technology like the Oculus Rift without being pursued or overshadowed by someone who's going to throw a crazy amount of money at a project almost exactly like yours just to beat you. Like, there's no real room for, like, and it's all about this ecosystem stuff. It's all about the fact that, oh, I'm Google. I'm not happy with the fact that these Pebble guys can make a watch that works with me. I got to make an Android-focused watch. I got to lock you into this ecosystem. I'm Facebook. I got to get the Oculus Rift. Right. Everyone wants the Oculus Rift. I got to get the Oculus Rift so people come to my system. Yeah. And that's what I'm saying is the interesting – I'm not going to call it scary. I'm not going to call it whatever. I'm just going to say that it's an interesting new way to look at the world. The acquisitions are – they're not just like little tiny acquisitions. These are high-profile, big-dollar acquisitions for companies that would otherwise make their way in the world. And
What you're talking about is proprietary control rather than
open source?
Open access control.
Not necessarily open source.
It's open access control, sort of like Oculus can make a whole bunch of APIs and it could work with everything. No. We want proprietary control.
Benchmark is what I'm talking about. It's kind of like, you know, the concept of, like, you know, having – do you remember back in the day – this is going way back, but back in the day when you got an Atari or something like that, you could buy a generic controller that would fit and work.
Sure.
You didn't have to get the genuine, you know what I'm saying? And that still exists to a degree with the modern systems. But in this case, what we're looking at is the adoption and acquisition of these technologies where these big companies basically turn them into proprietary products where they're set to an individualized standard so that you are locked in to their standard rather than an open standard that is...
Yeah, into their ecosystem. Yeah.
Exactly. And so you're looking at this segmentation between the companies where there is no... The benchmarks and the standards are all mixed up because it's all proprietary. You know, I work in a particular brand of computers. I won't mention the brand on the show, but where I work, we work on a particular brand of computers. Those parts are not interchangeable with other brands. In modern PCs, in modern desktops, it's all proprietary parts designed with specific connectors. And it's a real pain in the ass.
I think it underscores this trend that we're seeing in modern tech giants and how they're moving. And it's something that we have to just keep an eye on. And on the other hand, you know, as fans of what the Rift is doing and capable of doing, we're going to have to wait and see. And kind of with bated breath, because the Rift represented a whole new world, like Aladdin and Jasmine style on a carpet. Like, yeah. It represented something very different, very new. And we'll see. I mean, Facebook has a reasonable track record with Instagram. We'll see how they do with WhatsApp. And let's not forget WhatsApp went from $19 billion or $16 to $19 billion in stock and cash. So, you know, we'll see. Facebook is also shoving its weight around Silicon Valley, it seems. They've basically thrown out, you know, more than $25 billion in acquisitions in the last 2 years. That's a lot of acquisition money.
That's a lot of nuts.
I think the reaction to this has been fairly divisive amongst the tech community. Marcus Persson, the creator of Minecraft, also known as Notch, said in a blog post, he said, "Of course, Oculus wanted Minecraft. I said that it didn't really fit the platform, but perhaps it'd be cool to do a slimmed down version. So our people started talking to their people, and then not 2 weeks later, Facebook buys them." And he goes on to say, "Facebook is not a company of grassroots tech enthusiasts. Facebook is not a game tech company. Facebook has a history of caring about building user numbers and nothing but building user numbers. People have made games for Facebook platforms before, and while it worked great for a while, they're stuck in a very unfortunate position where Facebook eventually changed the platform to better fit the social experience they're trying to build. Don't get me wrong, VR is not bad for social. In fact, I think social could become one of the biggest applications of VR, being able to sit in a virtual living room and see your friend's avatar, business meetings, virtual cinemas. But I don't want to work with social. I want to work with games. I definitely want to be a part of VR, but I will not work with Facebook. Their motives are too unclear and shifting, and they haven't historically been a stable platform. There's nothing about their history that makes me trust them and that makes them seem creepy to me. And I didn't chip in $10,000 to seed a first investment round to build value for a Facebook acquisition."
Mm.
He says, "I understand this is purely a business deal, and I'd like to congratulate both Facebook and the Oculus owners, but this is where we part ways."
Yeah, so he's basically bringing out. It's not, he's not even talking about the selling out nature. He's just saying, this is difficult for anyone who's focused on games.
Yeah,
to see this technology being applied to games in a focused manner, and for those people who bought into Oculus, who spent the money, there's a large chance they'll be disappointed, and that's where I think a lot of the controversy comes from because. People, I mean, Oculus was a Kickstarter. Oculus had made, you know, a Kickstarter is always gambles, let's not forget, but promises of a certain culture and everything were made, and those promises are in jeopardy. They may be kept, they may not be kept. Frankly, Facebook can give Oculus the resources it needs to go where it wants to go before anything else. So let's not forget that. But this is definitely an interesting admonition by someone who is another independent game person.
Let's take one last break here. And when we return, our drill down video of the week is hot, hot, hot. So take a listen to this and come on back.
1, 2, 3, 3, 3.
Push!
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Greg Davies from Blendover Podcast.
Greg, what's your middle initial?
T.
Wow. If only your first name were Russell. Are you related?
No.
Oh. Just checking.
The heritage is the same. I do have family in my family tree that originated from Wales.
And Greg is a huge Doctor Who fan.
Oh, yeah. He's the hugest Doctor Who fan. So Russell T. Davies, for those who don't know, was instrumental in bringing Doctor Who back to the world of geek in 2005. And Greg is almost the same name. So, you know, I had to ask.
That's the only reason I'm cool to Dwayne.
That's the only reason we have him on the
many,
show.
Greg. It's one of many reasons you're cool to me.
This is our drill down video of the week. It's got to be hands down one of the most amazing videos, eyewitness videos of a fire and an eyewitness video of a rescue attempt that I think I've ever seen, and it's so clear and crisp and just amazing to watch. I don't know if you guys got a chance to take a look at this.
Oh, yeah. I did see it. I want to mention my objection. I had originally asked Andy to put on a clip of what's become my favorite TV show from Greg's homeland, H2O Just Add Water. But I was overruled. That Ricky is just such a rebel.
Next week, I promise, it'll be all H2O Just Add Water all the time for us.
If you guys haven't seen that, check it out. You're not going to.
My 9-year-old daughter loves it.
Especially if you have a 9-year-old daughter.
So this was this occurred earlier in the week. It was at AIG campus in Houston, Texas, and it was in a apartment complex that was still being built, and a fire had erupted. And onlookers from the a nearby building across the street took this video, and it's just an amazing video of the whole top floor of this complex burning down while someone who's stuck in the building is trapped on the landing of the top floor, on a top floor landing. And keep in mind now that because this is still being constructed, there are no railings or anything. It's just a landing without – that's just
– Landing on a ledge.
Landing on a ledge. It's just jutting out there in the middle of nowhere. The fire's burning around him. The people who are taking the video can feel the heat, the intense heat. That's how hot it is. Imagine how hot it was for the person standing on that landing. So as the
clearly he needed Emma to use her power to cool it all down.
Oh, stop.
H2O. It was just the tension was so thick from your discussion, from your description. I had to cut it.
The
tension in the video itself is actually quite remarkable. It was, you know, somebody needs to like add a theme song to it, like or something, you know. It's just remarable.
A little Hans Zimmer from the
From the backdraft, like that, you know,
from the backdraft soundtrack.
There's a part in the video that you need to see to believe, and the dude actually makes a move that you've seen in movies where the character moves from the upper ledge to the lower ledge by swinging below to it.
Yeah,
and it's just remarkable because usually. Two things are going to happen. You're either going to end up on your ass and you're going to survive, or you're going to fall to your death. And I'm not going to tell you which one happens, but it's a remarkable video.
It's something that I have only seen performed by stuntmen in movies before and with camera tricks.
This is the power of movies. They teach us how to survive these awful situations. And that's just something I've got to say. And we've got to stick together.
absolutely, though, absolutely compelling video. You got to check it out. And it's our drill down video of the week. All right, we're going to wrap it up here. But before we do, I'm going to go around the table here. And I'm going to start with our guest, Greg Davies, and ask you, where can we find your work on the internet when you're not helping us out on the drill down?
Man, you can catch me over at blendover.com. That is where the podcast is. Whether the podcast that I do resides on these fine interwebs that you're listening to us on. It's also available through iTunes and Stitcher. And we actually, in addition to having the recorded version of the podcast, when we record, we also do it live at blendover.com/live on Monday nights and Friday nights, which is 8:30 Central or 6:30 on the Pacific Coast, 9:30 on the East Coast. I hope you can come by and check it out. And if I could just explain the premise, Blendover is basically a podcast where we make a list of things that are trending in the news. Our show notes are the complete opposite of the drill down. We make a list of things we're not going to talk about. The idea is that we avoid what the mainstream media is basically forcing down your throat and grab a few stories that we think deserve a little bit of extra coverage.
Yeah, that's what I really appreciate about Blendover is that you guys deliberately avoid the headlines and surface stories that people are not talking enough about. So right. you're giving those stories legitimacy and presence. And that's a refreshing change from most weekly news podcasts.
Right. That's what Whereas, we try to give context to stories that are trending and try to make them make sense because they're kind of just out there because the media has no responsibility of what they actually shoot out. You guys are out there finding new stuff, which is always great.
Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always check me out on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, that's DwayneD. And you can check me out on Google+, gplus.to, where I'm posting links and all that stuff. And you can always find me here on the Drill Down. And maybe one day you'll find me on the Blendover as a guest.
Well, we're doing guest co-hosts at the moment. You should sign up to hang out with us for an episode.
Absolutely.
There you go.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. If you Google Mr. Babyman, you'll find all my social links up there because that's my social media handle. As for the drill down, if you have a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can always let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience. If you're selling something, write to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details on how to get your message to our listeners. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of the Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Dilly go.
No problem. Wait, there's one more thing I'm doing. I'm creating an entire blog that actually reviews every episode of H2O Just Dead Water.
You know, you would have a lot of followers if you did that, I guarantee you. Even though
it's a transformative series.
Yeah, yeah. Have you gotten into the other series, the H2O, I forget what it's called.
No, I think it's like the Mermaids of Mako Island, but I'm going to get to that after I watch H2O Just Dead Water again.
No, there's no.
I mean, are you talking about the series that I think you're talking about, like this old kids show?
Yes.
It's not old. It came out in 2007. It's the whole thing.
Oh, no.
I'm telling you. In fact, Andy, I think we should go out on the theme music. Hit it.
Mako Island of Secrets is the follow-up series, by the way.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not there. I'm still trying to figure out why Ricky's just such a rebel. The best part is that Cleo.
You need to watch BMX Bandits.
Oh, BMX Bandits. Well, you're talking about the...
Netflix has a whole list of things I have to watch because of this. Not the least of which is BMX Bandits.
You're talking about the legendary, one of the legendary early appearances of Nicole Kidman.
Yes, sir.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I really find that this show reminds me of the best parts of Saved by the Bell and Swan's Crossing.
Jesus, bloody hell.
I pride myself on watching some of the most mentally challenging, intellectually capable TV, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm obsessed with the themes deep within Battlestar Galactica or The West Wing or The Newsroom or The Americans or whatever. But I saw this show and I just got this time warp back to 1992.
even though it's not that old of a show.
No, it came out in 2007 or 2006 rather, and I got a time warp back to 1992 when I was watching shows Swan's Crossing and Saved by the Bell and Degrassi or whatever reruns, and I just feel like they hit on this formula that combines all that with the Power Rangers somehow, and yeah, it's addictive because it's so focused on dealing with the kinds of mistakes that people this age would make if they had these problems, which they would never actually have. And there's something that's really compelling about that. I find it to be a sociologically brilliant show. In fact, I wonder how relevant it is to the lives of everyday Australians.
Very, very little, my friend, I can tell you that. I will say one thing. I think I'd prefer you watching that instead of crap like they've churned out like Neighbours. My God.
What, no Natalie Imbruglia for you?
Only with the volume turned down, mate.
Well, there you go. You go.